Yes, Catherine.
I'll walk in. Exactly.
Wonderful.
Thank you for coming. We appreciate it. We've even got your slides up there.
Wonderful. So good morning, everyone. I can't believe what a beautiful venue we have here. I didn't know there was anything as pretty at MIT, but we certainly found it this morning. Wonderful. So today, I'm a professor at Sloan, and as you heard, I'm a marketing professor. So what we thought we'd do is we'd start off by thinking about, in a granular level, about future monetization options for video. And to do this, what I'm going to do is study a new form of advertising, which people tend to be excited about, and I'm going to lay out some of the pros and cons. And this new form of advertising is the practice of using viral videos. And these are where the idea is you put an ad on YouTube, and what's great is not only do you not really have to pay for it to be on YouTube, but people actually love the ad so much they share it with your friends. In other words, it's invited advertising, not that kind of push advertising we're told to always worry about. And I have the pleasure of teaching many MBA students. When I ask them about what marketing communications they're thinking about, they almost always pick viral video, right? Because of these attractive properties, that it's both cheap and you get lots of shares organically. Now, and as a result, there's an entire industry which tracks how well advertising performs in this viral arena. That is, measure the number of shares a particular ad gets. And what this research I'm going to do is say, well, let's imagine we're hugely successful at making an ad viral. Will that viral ad perform as well as a regular ad? In other words, is there going to be a trade-off between achieving this kind of organic reach and people sharing our ad and how persuasive the ad is in terms of selling to people? Now, what we did in terms of finding this out is, this was a very much sort of question-driven research project, so I went out and collected the data. We were lucky enough that we had contacts with the major agency which measures how well video ads perform. And so we got data from them on the day-by-day virality or number of views 400 ads got. The next thing I had to do, though, was work out, well, how well do these ads perform? And to do this, we did a massive crowdsourcing effort where we had 25,000 different surveys launched. And in each survey, the person saw either the focal ad for a product or a placebo ad for, say, a charity. And then we asked them, how likely were you to buy a product? And the difference between seeing the control ad, that's ad for a charity, the placebo, and having seen the focal ad is what we're going to call persuasiveness. And we measure this by a shift in purchase intent across these two groups. Now, what we found was, in some sense, slightly bad news for this new industry, in that when we measure persuasiveness in this very traditional way, which we've always measured TV advertising by, the more viral an ad is, the less likely it is to persuade the consumer watching it that to buy the product. And what we show in the paper is, why is this? Well, in order to persuade people to share an ad, you have to drop out the typical commercial product content, which actually explains why you might want to buy the product, in order to achieve people sharing their ad and the ad actually being viral. Now you might say, okay, fine, we have to sacrifice some ad performance to make things viral, but does that really matter? Because lots of people are seeing our ad. So we tried to write some simulations on this, and what we found was that, well, if you look at the total proportion of people persuaded, that is the number of people persuaded by how persuasive the ad was, then because of this decreasing ability to persuade, there's a concave relationship, and actually around 3 to 4 million views on average, this is very much an average figure, the ads really stop becoming effective because they've had to sacrifice so much product content in order to get people to share them. Now, of course, in general, I sort of give this presentation to marketing professionals and they say, well, you know, you're not surprising us. Anytime you do marketing, there are always going to be trade-offs. We're more interested, is there ever an upside? That is, can you ever make an ad persuasive and have people share the ad at the same time? And we found the one exception to this trade-off was when the ad is funny. That is, if an ad is funny, you're able to achieve both persuasiveness and people sharing it. Now, this is not a surprise because there's an old literature in marketing from the 1960s and 70s which suggests that humor, in some sense, enables you to allow a consumer to invite you in. And that, therefore, sharing a funny ad, even if it does contain information about product characteristics, is seen as somewhat more acceptable than sharing just a very commercial ad. Now, the other flip side is this is where there's a win-win if they're funny. But there's also a kind of ad which achieves a lot of shares which is particularly ineffective. And these are ads which are very outrageous and provocative. So I actually looked at my data at the 400 ads to see which the most provocative ad was. And it was actually an ad for M&Ms, which involved someone getting, like a hairy gentleman, getting his chest hair waxed. And this scored the highest in terms of being provocative, right? You can imagine the poor gentleman, his hair's been waxed, he's screaming in pain. It was very provocative, and it also will not surprise you to learn that having watched someone get their chest hair waxed, people are not really in the mood to buy M&Ms, right? There's a little bit of a disconnect here. So that's an illustration of a general pattern that when you achieve shares by being particularly edgy, particularly provocative, then that's when we see the biggest trade-off between achieving shares and outrageousness. Now, you know, this was a new pattern. Of course, want to be careful about the limitations of it. So the data comes from around 2010, and it's for consumer products. Why consumer products? Well, we wanted to look at products where you got a reasonable chance with an ad to shift purchase intention. So that wouldn't happen with cars, so that's why we looked at low-priced consumer products. Another worry you may have is the way we did these 25,000 surveys is that we forced people to look at the ads. That's going to be a worry. You're also going to worry about who these survey takers were. The one thing I can reassure you about, though, is that in terms of their profiles, though these survey takers were on average more male and younger than the average population, they look very like in terms of demographics, the YouTube people on YouTube. We didn't look at any effects on awareness. We were really just looking at purchase intention towards established products like yogurt. And also, I just took the ad design as given, what the ad design the agencies came up with. We didn't try and manipulate that in any clever ways. So, let's just sum up. So, in general, anytime you're in a room of millennials who are trying to think about advertising, they are immediately attracted by the idea of video advertising. Why? Well, it feels that both you're going to get very low costs, and not only that, but your ad is going to be shared because people find it interesting, and that kind of invited reach feels very attractive. However, what my research shows is even though this invited reach or earned reach feels very attractive, you're going to have to sacrifice something about the ad design in order to achieve it. And in particular, you're going to have to sacrifice the normal parts of an ad where you push product or describe where the product is attractive in order to achieve this reach. The one exception is if you can make the ad funny enough that you enable people to share what might feel as otherwise commercial content because the humor, in some sense, neutralizes the commercial content. So with that, I would absolutely love to have any questions you may have about this study. Yes?
I was really taken by your comment about the M&Ms waxing, but that sounds like two things that just seem like a dumb idea, right? But what happens when they scare you and then they do the insurance ad? So like,
are you thinking about a certain Super Bowl ad by any chance?
The question is, I assume you control for that kind of thing.
Okay, really good question. So the first thing I want to say is that you might say that M&M ad seems like a very bad idea when I describe it, but in the way these ads are actually measured by advertising agencies and the product firms themselves, This ad was enormously successful. It received millions of views, right? So you're saying it sounds like a dumb idea, but with the traditional metrics used by the industry, this was a successful ad. What my research was adding to it was the sort of incremental thing was, are these ads actually effective, right? Now, we had various words. We had outrageous, we had provocative, I think we had sad. So sad's probably the closest we get to frightened or scared. And for all of those words, you saw the more pronounced trade-off. Yes?
Is that on? Humor as the one that cuts through. Is that, did you look at the sort of the emotional visceral connection? I'm thinking about like the Apple's Think Different campaign. You know, was that separate? Did you not look at that, or was that humor captured that too?
So it's obviously difficult to separate humor, but what we did get as a sort of separate component is in a similar bucket to humor, it was also visual appeal. So that when you saw the ad and it was visually appealing, imagine, I guess, beautiful scenery or something like that, or something very evocative, then you also loosen the trade-off. Not quite as powerfully as you do with humor, but you do see a loosening of the trade-off. Yes?
Quick question about the depth of research here, especially as regards this last point on this slide around understanding the earned versus paid debate. Did you do any analysis of essentially whether the advertisers got good value even though there was concavity, and they paid for the original ad development in some initial, but as they got some additional exposure because of the virality. Was that a good deal or not for them in terms of who they reached and purchasing behavior beyond what they paid for relative to sort of a baseline case as a comparison?
Okay, so I want to be a little bit circumspect here, but let me try and answer that question as much as I can. So I talked about the results with a company who, shall we say, is very interested in the future of television advertising in order to get some of that sort of baseline insight. And what they told me, I mean, let's be clear, in general, the production values for a viral video ad, you know, if it's a good one, it's still probably going to be less than half of the price of anything you might invest on a typical TV ad, right? So we already have a lower baseline cost. My estimate suggested you're still probably not going to be able to supplant that baseline average cost effect, right? That's still going to predominate when you're trying to do the whole trade-off. And I think at that point, we were sort of left with the fact that for TV advertising, you've got a far broader reach than we're able to achieve here. Because one part of the research was seeing that really in some sense in YouTube, the reach or the population you're able to target with the ads is a lot narrower than on TV advertising. But I don't think my research gives a sort of cost argument for why this fails. It's more persuasiveness I fail. Yeah.
Do you have any intuition as to how that kind of trade-off works in the case of ads whose job is not for you to buy something, like the Apple Think Different, or I'm thinking of like the little movies that Guy Ritchie and others made for BMW that, you know, I mean, the purpose wasn't for you to run out and buy a BMW or even necessarily buy an Apple, but rather to change your consciousness. And how do you have any intuition as to how it might work in those?
Okay, really good question. So in some sense, I was probably looking for this effect in an arena where we might expect this effect because it was persuasiveness for already established products. I wasn't really looking at the kind of shifts in awareness that you're thinking about. Now, I did what I could with the data to see if I could see any differences by levels of awareness in this trade-off. It didn't seem to be really driving the results. So what I can say is for this, awareness is not what's driving the results, but I didn't separately study awareness or those kind of water cooler effects we might think of.
Yes, okay. So one of the things that we hear a lot about in terms of advertising is that people just don't want to watch ads, period. And so I think the kind of ads that Andy talked about are really an attempt to get to sort of develop at least brand awareness or brand attachment through entertainment type approaches. And, you know, you're talking about stripping out the part of advertising that makes it feel like an ad in an attempt to make it something that people will share, which makes it more like entertainment than an ad. I know I'm not formulating a very specific question here, but does your research speak at all to this ad avoidance and ad blocking trend that seems to be becoming more prominent or more often discussed among advertisers who are afraid of just being ignored altogether because they are advertising?
Okay, so this particular paper does not speak to this. Maybe if I talk to give you some few facts, because it's of interest to the people here, about some data. So, first of all, consumers say they really dislike intrusive ads. Unfortunately, from an advertising perspective, these ads work twice as well, if you're looking at online. The question is what else can you do? And the answer is, what else you can do is use to achieve that kind of effectiveness is to use highly personalized data to tailor advertising for the consumer. And so this sets us up for an easy trade-off, given what we're talking about today, that we can either intrude on consumers by being very interruptive and interfering with their experience, and that makes advertising work, or we can intrude on them in a different way, which is by collecting personalized data and tailoring the ads, but we have, in some sense, a choice of paths between in front of us as an industry when we're trying to settle this. Yes?
In a normal television production, we have a kind of advertisement inside the content, like we call merchandising or product placement.
Product placement, yes.
You have any new ideas about this, any changes in this, using this concept that you mentioned?
Okay. So, I must admit, I haven't looked at product placement. Let me tell you a little bit about the research done by one of my colleagues over at Boston College, who's looked at it in this new world of video. And what he's found is that product placement works surprisingly well, even when it's very much done at the periphery. In that, you know, we're always worried that sort of product placement is too intrusive. And what he's found is that he was looking at video games to be specific, but he found that it actually works better around the periphery of the game rather than being too forced or too centralized. And I think that sort of fits into this motif of my research too.
Have you considered at all the question of the vehicles that are used for sharing? Is it, you know, whether it's Facebook or email or games or, you know, and the nature of the groups that the ads are shared among? Because I would think that the tighter knit groups might actually be more effective. If I have 5,000 friends, then that's much more diluted than if I have 50.
Okay, so this is not this paper, but I've written. I accidentally always try and write at the new paper, and then I always end up writing this paper on whichever new social media platform I study. So we looked at this once on Facebook and found a similar degree of trade-offs in that customers were very resistant to purposely social advertising where it mentioned friends or friends liking a product if it was accompanied by commercial content. The only exception we found to that, which we were able to find on Facebook because we got a bit more space to play with targeting, is that if, for the average population, that's true, but if you look at the kind of people who have liked a fashion brand on Facebook, they don't have this trade-off. So any people who are purposely using social media platforms to embrace commercial content and make it part of their identity, we don't see this trade-off or, in some sense, resistance to commercial content paired with friendship. For the average person, though, that's not true.
So I guess that's a very similar, my question was very similar. Where do you see this future in terms of, and I think you touched on that, Sinan Aral, one of your colleagues, talked about the ad blocking recently on NPR and talked about this, the personalization. Do you see this being also dynamically generated in the future to where some social signaling will be inserted in these videos? Because this production is happening once, and the running of the ad is viral and is many. Do you think the future of this will be more with social signaling and personalization to where it addresses that?
Okay, wonderful. So just in case you haven't heard about my colleague Sinan Aral's research, his thesis, he did this really beautiful paper where he showed that this kind of virality works a lot better if you invite people in to do personalization rather than forcing them to do your social messaging for you. Now, what I can add to that in terms of where I think we're going is that advertisers often take a very passive view of what the consumer's role should be in this personalization process. But another paper I've written shows that actually, if you're going to have highly personalized advertising of the kind of future you're thinking about, you really need easy to understand and transparent privacy controls. In that, I looked at a situation where you had the before the privacy controls and after. And what I found is that before the privacy controls, these personalized ads, the alleged future of our profession, really didn't work at all well. They just looked like an average ad. But the moment you add that degree of control towards the personalization, they actually perform 3 times as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. I know you have to run. You left a lot of pointers to paper, so I expect people will go look for that. But I think I encourage you to do some wonderful stuff. I think we're able to really meet. But I know you have to run, so thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, and I will go and teach some students some marketing.
Good.